Just a warning before we begin that you should expect to be spoiled to a greater or lesser degree for all of the video games being discussed today. I hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We're back this time around to continue with some video game discussion with the second installment of our VOK Video Game Hall of Fame. As before, our goal today is to induct two particularly special games into our very important, very established Hall of Fame that we have here. To do that, everyone here has come up with a game that they will nominate, make the case for, and ideally have voted in. We will take turns presenting and then cross-examining each pick and hold a vote that will determine the two winners. My name is Zach, also known as Alias on various places of the internet, and joining me for this round of Hall of Fame discussions, we have...
Hey, it's Matt. Ready to get goosed again.
Hello, this is Bing. Shoeshiner on the forum, former forums. I think they're still there. I'm just not really on there.
Still there.
It's your boy, Alex. Also known as Lucky Charms on Discord and the forums.
It's Katie, Lady Griffin on the forums, Dead Leaves in My Hand on the Discord.
Greetings, mortals. It is I, Patrick, the Toll on the forums. And, I don't have anything.
I'm Jock everywhere.
So, just a reminder on some of the rules and format for this before we get into it. Of course, these are subject to change and to further evolution as we go, but I think we'll stick with what we did last time for the time being. So the voting should be weighted toward the quality of the presentation as much as your opinion of the game being presented. We're going to have a lot of really good games discussed, as we always do, but of course, that is not the only factor for how you should vote. You should also take into account how they describe the game, their level of passion, and all that nonsense. As of right now, there will be no hard time limits for your presentations, but try to keep it around 5 to 10 minutes approximately, and we'll look to keep our cross examinations around the same length, just to keep this at a relatively reasonable length. Everyone will get three votes as we conclude, as we decide. We will get three votes, and they will be each respectively worth 3, 2, and 1 point, and you spread those across three different games of your choice. So that's the deal. All right, let's go ahead and get going here. And the random order decided by fate has determined that Katie should go first.
I knew it. Okay. Well, last time I presented to the jury the great Barbie Writing Club 98.
It was an epic performance.
I'm glad we all respected it. I remember it got 4 points. I still, it's a good memory. I thought about doing something similar this time around, but unfortunately I couldn't resist the call anymore. So my game, it's Dragon Age 2. No one is surprised. So I first played Dragon Age 2 back in 2012. I was desperate for a game that captured the magic of Mass Effect. Basically, Mass Effect 3 had just come out, and I was obsessed with Mass Effect, but there was nothing really like Mass Effect, and so I was hungry for something to satisfy that BioWare niche. And a friend of mine, former podcaster Death Sheep, some of you might remember him, Daniel, he recommended Dragon Age 2 to me. And I resisted because I had a sophisticated fantasy palette that was too sophisticated for a game that had elves in it. But the thirst overcame me, and I reluctantly and grudgingly bought the game and played it. And like a teenager skinny dipping in a pond of toxic waste, I had no idea how deeply it would ravage my mind, body, and soul for the next decade to come. If a doctor were to diagnose me, they would only have to review my 100,000-word fanfic to stamp the word terminal on my file. It's a sickness. It's a sickness. But, do you want to play a game with well-designed maps and rewarding loot? Well, too bad. Do you want a game that rewards the choices you made in Dragon Age Origins in a meaningful way? Well, go fuck yourself. Do you want to hang out with a cast of underwritten neurotic homosexuals in a dirty city you call home? this is the game for you. I don't know why I love this game so much. It might be because I've never played anything else quite like it. Unlike Dragon Age Origins and Inquisition, DA2 isn't about the end of the world. There are no evil gods to topple, no apocalypses to avert. The story is small in scope and personal. You play as Hawk, who arrives in the city of Kirkwall as a refugee from the Ferelden Blight. The story follows him or her over the course of a decade as he or she rises in prominence within the City of Chains, all with very little urgency. You scrape together coin, you buy a new house, you try to save your tiny, traumatized family. The focus of the game is more about the daily lives of the hero and his or her friends as they try to stay out of trouble. It's the most domestic action game I have ever played. The game also has a unique framing device told as a story within a story by Hawk's best friend and biographer, Varric Tethras, who is being interrogated by the game's in-world church. It's a constant reminder that even as you build a new home for yourself, you are destined to lose it to forces more powerful than yourself. Despite Hawk's best attempts to live a normal life, the city's warring factions eventually demand that you make a choice, one that will destroy everything you've worked for. It's well known that the development for DA2 was troubled. The dev team had less than 11 months to turn what was supposed to be an expansion for Origins into a full-fledged game. The result is a rough diamond of cut corners and ruthlessly reused assets. It was poorly received upon release by fans and critics alike. But art can come from adversity. The small scope lends itself to a personal story. The single location of Kirkwall makes the city feel like home. If Origins and Inquisitions are Lord of the Rings, then DA2 is Cheers. It's a game that definitely shows its age, but I find it comforting to return to. I played it during one of the most lonely periods of my life when I was extremely ill and unsure if I was going to make it to the age of 30. It feels lame to say it, but at a time when I didn't have any friends to turn to, there was something safe about being able to turn this game on over and over again and hang out with the in-game friends. The characters feel like family to me, because for a while they were. I struggle to recommend this game because it doesn't suit most people's tastes. It definitely feels old playing it now. But if you go into it with an open heart and lowered expectations, you might have a good time. You might even come to love Kirkwall and its misfits and its three reused dungeons. And that's it. That's all I got.
Well, that was predictably excellent. Thank you, Katie, for that. Very much appreciated. So let us unleash the hounds upon Dragon Age 2. Give it your all, guys.
God, I don't even know what to say.
I can take it, you cowards.
I think it was the weakest of the three, honestly.
You son of a bitch.
How dare you?
It's I'm sorry, the first one had so many meaningful choices that influences the whole world. As you say, there is very little, you know, effect upon the world really from number two. I played it and I guess I enjoyed it, but only because I refused to just do it as a chore. Because I like Dragon Age as the trilogy, and I even appreciate the game, the middle game, but the bookends are better for that one.
So I think, Katie, one thing that's interesting that I just heard is that, did you play Dragon Age 2 before Dragon Age Origins?
I did.
I think that makes a huge difference, right? Because your experience is shaped by Dragon, your first your experience of the Dragon Age world is shaped by Dragon Age 2, whereas I think most people play 2 after Origins and expected there were expectations going into 2 that you didn't have. So that changed. I think that changes the equation completely.
Yeah, that is definitely an impression that I've gotten, is that people who loved Origins and were expecting a continuation of that game and more like Origins were extremely disappointed, because it's a very, very different product. And the same way, like, all three of the Dragon Age games are very different from each other, but the change from Origins to DA2 is probably the most shocking.
I will say for me that It is true that I do like Origins more, and I did play Origins first, for whatever that is worth. It just, like, for me, does more for me to tickle, like, the RPG brain. And I just think that, like, there's so much in it that is so, I don't know, just so enrapturing to me about the setting, like, and all the places you go and all this stuff. So it definitely is kind of a culture shock in Dragon Age 2 to be kind of, like, trapped in this one place. But I will say, like, compared to many people, like, I love that place. Like, I love Kirkwall as a setting. And I do acknowledge that there are a lot of weaknesses to it in terms of, like, how it reuses its assets and how limited it feels, especially compared to the other games. But I do genuinely vibe with a lot of the stuff that you're talking about the game. Like, I'm always actually surprised, like, how much people dislike it, because, like, I totally felt what you were saying when I played it, that idea of it being, like, a domestic game. I love that point, because I think... like, for me, like, the idea of a game where, like, you're in the same place and time, you have, like, a bunch of time skips and you see how things change and evolve over that period. Like, I love that idea. Like, I think that's a really fun way to approach a story. So I do always appreciate that about the game whenever I play it. And I do like the characters, but I think it does end up just, like, falling short to its limitations, ultimately, for me. Like, I still enjoy the game, but it just feels like when you mention art from adversity, like, I totally buy into that concept. I love that concept, and there's probably some of that came through here, but I think most of it just ends up feeling like adversity to me when you play it, because you just feel like there's a lot of opportunities that they had to expand things that they just didn't get a chance to because of the nature of the development.
Yeah. And in reading some of the, like, production notes, like, years and years later from people who worked on it, they all talk about how, like, if they could go back, they would make it, they would do away with, like, the time skips, and they would make it take place in, like, a shorter span of time. And that kind of breaks my heart, because I think that's one of the game's strongest strengths, is it's just...
I'd agree, yeah.
Yeah, it's a focus on a person's life changing over the course of, I think, 7 or 8 years. And sort of the losses and the gains of that and how your friends change. And that's, to me, that's way more appealing of a story, even though I do, it's the weakest game of the three, like, just mechanically and structurally and as a role-playing game. But, like, that kind of story as just someone whose life is caught up in the fact, like, who is not a hero, like, who just sort of becomes a hero by accident over the course of time because of, like, what they've stumbled into, is more interesting to me than the other two stories. And unfortunately, it's not a kind of game that would ever be made again, just because it failed badly, and it's just not a very commercial story to tell. But it's important to me for that reason. And I think that's why, like, people who love it hard, love it really hard, especially, like, people who like, did fan art and fan fiction about it, I think. Like, the fandom community around the game, like, it just has a vibe that is very absent from, like, a lot of other AAA games. So,
But Katie, I can soothe you in the thought that BioWare seems to be very capable of messing things up nowadays. So you could get something just like that one.
Yeah, I mean, we have another game coming out. Maybe it'll be as much as a shit show as DA2 was.
Can't wait.
One can only hope.
Yeah, I mean, whatever vibe you're describing, I definitely, like, it touches my heart, I will say. Like, whatever that aspect of that game that it feels like not everyone gets, like, it did reach me for whatever reason, so I definitely appreciate it, and I certainly appreciate your particular passion for it. It's definitely rare that, like, someone, like, you know, has, like, such love for a particular game, and you can speak to it on, like, every level. Like, I don't think I really have that for, like, any game, maybe.
I don't know if it's a good thing. I think it's
maybe.
I think it's like a disease. Like, it's like I played it when I was at my most mentally ill, and now it's just, like, hardwired into, like, the most neurotic disease parts of my brain. Like, I can't get rid of it.
Perhaps. Any other takes and questions, thoughts on Dragon Age 2?
I think some of the criticisms are a bit overwrought due to the people coming from Dragon Age Origins. I think the game itself is perfectly fine. Again, it's different, but that doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just people's expectations coming from one just shifted the narrative around it too much, I think.
I also have a question then. Katie, which character is your favorite?
I mean, do you have to ask that?
I know the answer.
I can't tell if you're, like, pulling my leg or not.
Obviously, Bethany.
Hey, I love my little sister.
Fair.
No, but seriously, you, even though you might have a profile picture, nobody else can. None of our listeners.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, it's Fenris. Yeah.
And why is that?
Patrick, are you really asking me this?
Yes.
I think it just falls into like a character type that I like of like someone who is very damaged in a very unapologetic way, and you get to teach them how to read. Like, that is like my archetype. It's like, I don't know. I just like, I really like the voice. I really like the voice actor Gideon Emery. There's something about like the sarcasm of the character, like married to the depth of pain. I don't know. If there's any character in any story who's just like extremely angst-ridden and suffering, that's the person I'm going to be drawn to, no matter how many people make fun of me for it.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that.
How dare you? I feel exposed now.
I'm sorry. That's part of the exercise, you know.
I'm totally joking. I can
bare our hearts
Fenris all day, but I feel like I've talked about Fenris for a decade, so I'm just going to shut up about it.
Well, I thank you very much for sharing. Seriously, it was very, very good. All right. Next up, as decided by random order, we have Jock to make your case for your game.
Well, my pick is, as you probably expect, is set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Yes, of course, I am speaking about Minecraft. What can be said about Minecraft? It is one of the most popular games of all time. If Minecraft was a country, it would be the fifth most populous country after Indonesia. According to self-determination theory, there are three things that you that drive human behavior. The social, which is fulfilled in Minecraft through the use of multiplayer. The pursuit of mastery, which is pursued in Minecraft through the creation of ever elaborate creations. And of course, autonomy, which is almost perfected in Minecraft with having no direct goals and leaving the player up to their own to create their own fun. But I think the sense of autonomy is where Minecraft is most interesting from an academic point of view. In the book Punished by the Wards, The Trouble with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, Aids and Plays and Other Bribes by Alfie Cohen, he makes the argument that the standard use of incentives in pediology is causing children to be demotivated from learning. And I think Minecraft shows the perfect solution to this problem by showing many different pathways to the ability to create various learned environments through the creation of Minecraft structures. Other ways they've also shown the amazing things that children can learn to do through Minecraft is through the redstone circuit systems, where they have created even literal computers. And of interest to this group would be the entirety of Westeros has been created with nothing but intrinsic motivation, without the use for any form of incentives or applauding or goals by the players. So I do think Minecraft is the perfect way that we should, as a, not just a game, but as a manifesto for how we should build society, based not on the incentive-based behaviorism of carrot and stick model, but acknowledging the developments in business studies, pediology, and psychology, such as Taylorism, where business studies moved away from the carrot stick bonus punishment behavior model and started providing more scientific management, where businesses were allocated based on intrinsic motivation factors. Although we have moved away from this and back towards the carrot and stick model, since we should maybe move back to a more Minecraft-based model of society. And that's my presentation on why Minecraft is how we should guide society. And
whoa!
Excellent, dude. Yeah, that was great. as always, Jack, you really bring the thunder once again. So yeah, my mind is spinning right now as I consider the possibilities of this. But yeah, I'll open it up to everyone else. Like, what do you think of Minecraft, and how would you respond to that?
I've never played Minecraft, but I guess my question, like, is it because, like, you're incentivized to do stuff in Minecraft just because it allows you to do as much as you want, and you can kind of craft your interests in any way you want? Like, it gives you freedom, enough freedom of creativity that you can build incredible things. Is that sort of the argument is?
Yeah.
You can dig down until you hit the lava, and then the lava boils you alive.
Yeah, so, you can. Yeah.
I led a troop of creepers into a villager commune and blew it all up, and then took all of their resources. What does that say about me as a human being?
Sounds like you're very pragmatic and focused on accruing resources to me.
I saw some guy like stuff like 1,000 cows in a single house and then tear one wall down and they exploded out. I definitely think we should model society based on Minecraft. I do like your argument, Jock. It's I have seen like just incredible feats of creativity within Minecraft, just like on YouTube and stuff, of people who definitely feel like they have the tools to build whatever they want in the game space.
I have a question. Because do you pose the idea that complete autonomy is how we should govern our countries, like anarchy, basically?
Well, we're getting spicy and political out here.
Well, I agree with the anarchist principle of unjustified hierarchies, but obviously, like, there should still be some general constraints and central planning involved, but it should not be based on the carrot and stick model of attempting to lead with incentives and general behaviorism style, like logic relation.
Okay. I also like to, as a person who has, experience with teaching and schools, you mentioned that there was a lack of motivation. I think that autonomy in itself will also sort of lead to demotivation. You need to also have like attainable goals or a structure laid before you that you can act within. So I think Minecraft in itself has that. It's just very much behind the curtain. To do redstone, you need certain parts of materials that you need to get to do the fun stuff. And that means that you have goals. You just need to choose which goals are the ones you want to go after at that specific moment. I like Minecraft, but I think Minecraft is one of my main problems as a teacher is that you really do need to set the goals for the children if you want to make sure that they will learn. And I think that's probably the same thing for society. I think people intrinsically need palpable goals.
Sure. Is a goal the same thing as an incentive or a punishment, though?
I think what we need to think about is what are we asking people to do and is it reasonable? And then focus on collaboration and choice being given to people, which is sort of done in Minecraft, but not to the extent I would have on a societal level. Although mainly I was deciding Minecraft as a manifesto and how we should do the entirety of the world was mostly a joke, but it opens up good possibilities.
Yeah, Jock, I'm just, if I want to be critical, that's the only thing I can be critical about, because I love Minecraft. that's the only thing I can say, because I love that game. So, damn you for choosing such a good game.
I think the only thing I can say with keeping the frame of your argument in mind is that I do think Minecraft probably presents both like a sort of a approach with autonomy, but also a carrot and stick approach. Like the survival mode of Minecraft to me seems like pretty traditional carrot and stick motives. But it's cool that you get the two options of how you can approach it. I think that's actually something that gives it more flexibility. And I think to me, like the thing that I always find most interesting about Minecraft, and it folds into your argument, is the fact that it has been such a huge game for kids, like of various generations at this point. Like there's like more than one generation of kids that have grown up on Minecraft, and it's kind of interesting to see how that's evolved over time in terms of what they do with it and how they enjoy it. Like when I first saw Minecraft back in the day and sort of saw the content that, which is enormously popular, the content that sprung up around Minecraft, a lot of it was pretty simple, just like survival games. And eventually it became things like, there was like a Hunger Games mod, for Minecraft, which eventually you could argue is what, became like battle royale games and stuff like that. Like there are these interpretations, but now a lot of what I understand Minecraft to be like is like little like role play scenarios that people, at least the content around it, is like little role play scenarios that people make, and kids love this stuff. So it's kind of cool to see like all the different ways that it's engaged children in particular, and that it's still going strong with that to this day. I think the one like concern and question I'd have with it, I'm curious to see how you'd respond to it, again, like considering your argument, is that it kind of, Minecraft is kind of like a forerunner in the like iPadification of childhood, where like kids are raised watching videos and that's how they experience the world, or like that's how they are kept engaged when their parents don't want to engage them in other fashions. Do you think there's any issues with that or concern about that? Like I don't necessarily put the blame on Minecraft on that, but I would say it plays a significant role in that.
Well, as for Minecraft being used in forms of creating of garbage content on specifically YouTube, and creating a sort of pipeline of garbage content where kids are fed the pet of stuff which feeds their need for repetition, but also doesn't really provide them with anything, such as the famously in the 2010s, the whole pregnant Elsa Spider-Man craze that...
I don't know this one. It may be famous, but I don't know.
Due to like algorithms being pretty stupid, they pretty much fed kids anytime they'd click on like, say, Minecraft, would lead them to stuff with the default skin's name, Steve, collabing with some other IP that they know of, and that would lead them to ever sketchier stuff that would eventually lead them to things like pregnant Elsa fight Spider-Man and things like that.
Excellent. Thank you, Google. Thank you. Yeah, I think ultimately, like, Minecraft is the most positive aspect of, I don't know, like, all of those things about, like, modern gaming. Like, if I personally were to, like, rate, like, all the, like, most popular games and how they affect society, I would say Minecraft probably comes out as one of the best, one of the most positive forces. As with anything, it has its negative aspects, but I would say that it's doing good things for keeping people's minds open, especially young people. So I would definitely support that. All right. Any other thoughts, opinions, takes, questions on Minecraft? Cool. Well, thank you very much, Jock. That was great as always. Love it, what you bring to the table here. Well, we have one previous winner that just went up, and our next one is now has to answer the call again. So, Alex, your time has come to present your game.
So far off in the mythical land of Rockville, Maryland, there dwells a holy order of paladin warriors. They call themselves Bethesda Game Studios. Currently, perhaps like with a tarnished reputation for their scurrilous like business practices and releasing buggy unfinished games, but it was not always the case. You know, long ago they released still admittedly pretty buggy games, but games with heart and soul and cogent world building and themes and philosophy. So for the jury's consideration, Elder Scrolls III Morrowind, released in 2002 for PC and Xbox. This is an open world RPG video game. Main story takes place on the island of Vardenfell in the dark elf province of Morrowind in the Tamrielic Empire. Your main quest tasked with stopping the dark demigod Dagoth-Ur, who has returned seeking to defeat the Tribunal Temple and free Morrowind from the Empire. So I'm sure plenty of you are experienced with Oblivion or Skyrim. Like, we know the gist of Elder Scrolls, like, the way they're played. Like, you're a prisoner and you wake up in some altercation and you escape and you have this world, that's your oyster just to explore. And if I were to like litigate all the things I love about this game, we might be here a while. So I'm going to focus in on two things in particular. Firstly, like the world building. When I think of Oblivion, like the setting is just this kind of generic simulacrum of medieval Europe, Skyrim, high mimetic fantasy Scandinavia. Morrowind has no historical like antecedent. Like, this is a truly like alien fantasy world. Like, I remember you step off the boat at Saint-Denis and the first thing you see on the skyline is the Siltstrider Depot, which is what I would describe as a flea the size of an elephant that is like a beast of burden that the dark elves ride around. They don't cultivate cows. They have netch farms, which are gigantic airborne jellyfish that they harvest and domesticate. There are no horses. They ride guar, which are these bipedal lizards that are like a cross between a tadpole and a velociraptor. There are massive forests of mushrooms and volcanic wastelands. This is, you know, visiting Sedrith Mora, where the Imperial Army has a garrison, and it's just like this generic European castle, but the city itself is made of mushroom trees that have all been hollowed out, and the Dark Elves just live there. And no one comments about, well, this is such a fantastical, strange place, because for these characters, this is just the place that they live. Like, there's nothing special about this. Visiting Vivec City, the capital of Vardenfell, where the seat of where the God King Vivec reigns, the city is like multiple cantons that are built out in the ocean, connected by bridges, and they're like gondola drivers that'll take you around. Imagine like Venice by way of Tenochtitlan, you know, Mesoamerican Aztec architecture. And above the city floats the Ministry of Truth, where centuries past there was a meteor that was going to crash to the earth, and Vivec stretched out his hand and just stopped it in midair. And there it remains, you know, just floating above the city. This is anecdotal, but when I was in middle school, like around the time playing this, my best friend at the time, he was from a very conservative Christian family. And if ever I slept over, like on a Saturday night, I had to go to church with them in the morning, you know. There was no arguing out of that. And I was going through my petulant, militant atheist phase. So there were a lot of interesting conversations in the car ride. And I remember like one argument really well. Well, I'd only believe in God if, you know, there was some personal demonstration of its existence to me, you know, because obviously I'm just that important in the grand scheme of things. And I remember imagining myself as some dark elf commoner in Vivek City, and you know, every morning looking up and seeing that floating meteor, and just seeing that unfathomable but tangible proof that, you know, my God is real. You know, he exists. He walks this earth. There's no intercessory priests or prayer. I can just go talk to Vivek. He's so powerful. He doesn't need any guards to protect him. He's perfectly safe. And I, you know, what sort of attitude would that inculturate in someone? Like, certainly a sense of like paternalistic security and safety, but also like cultural chauvinism and like ethnocentrism and like we worship like the true gods and elsewhere everyone worships false idols and empty signifiers. And the culture of the dark elves that you experience in this game is like rampant institutional racism, the cultural chauvinism. Like, it all clarified for me in a way how deeply like Todd Howard and Michael Kirkbride, the like main writers, had thought about crafting this world. And suddenly I didn't feel like I was just playing an RPG grinding numbers, concerned about, well, I gotta get the XP up. I need that plus one sword. Instead, I felt like, you know, an anthropologist engaging in the cultural ecology of this fully formed alien secondary world. Like, so dense and real did it feel to me, like going through reading all the little lore books that you can find. I read all of those for this game. You know, a handful of RPGs in the intervening years, like, they've given me that magical feeling, but Morrowind was the first. My note here just says, talk about metaphysics and philosophy. I don't think we have time. let's talk about quest design. I get really frustrated when I play Skyrim, how the narrative cluster for like the major factions, how self-contained and compartmentalized they feel. Like, you complete the Thieves Guild quest in like its little isolated corner of the world space, and it doesn't intersect with anything else. It's designed in this way so that you can complete everything in one playthrough, but it ends up making that experience feel kind of artificial, like nothing really matters. This is most staggering when, you know, you assassinate the Emperor himself for the Dark Brotherhood. And does this affect the Skyrim Civil War? Not at all. Like, things just carry on normally. Not so with Morrowind. They're mutually exclusive, like, faction paths. In this game, there's the nativist dark elf criminal cartel, the Kimona Tong, engaged with this, like, shadowy underworld gang war with the Thieves Guild over, like, who's going to have primacy. And the Tongs have bought off and bribed the Fighters Guild to, like, fight this proxy war for them. You cannot complete the Thieves Guild and Fighters Guild main storylines. Like, you can start, but like eventually, like, this gang war is going to reach ahead and you have to choose a side. And there's no golden like third path to take if you have 100 speech, because these institutions, the bigotries, the prejudices, like the commercial, like money at stake, like, it's all too much. Like, your agency as a player, like, it's not going to put a scratch in that. There are the great houses, which are like aristocratic families, but also like political parties, like voting blocks. There are three of them that have fiefs on Morrowind, but you can only join one of them to the mutual exclusion of the others. And the men-at-arms guards of the other houses, if you're from a rival house, they'll try to fleece you for more money. You'll have a permanent relationship malice. Certain merchants won't even do business with you. They'll look at your political affiliation and say, we don't serve like House Lalu in this neck of the woods. Like, imagine, like, we only think of like merchants as like this vapid menu we would interact with, like, but being like politically motivated to turn away the player, like, I love stuff like that. For me, what's foundational to this and what makes the like role-playing choices matter is narrative opportunity cost. What does that mean? If the player makes choice A, they only engage with the content and story of choice A and precludes engaging with any of the content for choices B, C, or D. You miss out on that. And like that upsets people. Like you gnash their teeth, like I'm not getting my money's worth, I'm wasting my time. You mean I have to replay the game? Because in the real world, like our time is a finite resource. If you're doing one thing, you can't be doing something else. That's what makes our choices matter for whatever we're doing. And these principles for, you know, microeconomics applied to game design, like for your choices to matter, like the path you choose, you have to lose out on something else. And like maybe that's frustrating or disappointing, but that loss makes the choices matter. Narrative opportunity costs. Miscellaneous. The music for this game, like Jeremy Sewell. We all know the Elder Scrolls theme, the drum lead in dun, 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 dun. 20 years ago, it wasn't the Elder Scrolls theme. It was just the Morrowind theme. And that it has so like encapsulated the musical identity of this series should speak to the caliber of the score. Running a bit long, so. Sophisticated, peerless world building and immersion. Excellent narrative and quest design. This really is a peerless RPG experience. And to say this earnestly, returning to Vivec City as an impoverished level 1 character and having racial slurs hurled at me by Dark Elf commoners, it makes me feel right at home.
Beautifully done, beautifully done. Thank you, Alex. A lot of good points made there about Morrowind. I guess I'm curious, before we open it up, has anyone else played Morrowind?
Yeah, I'm sure plenty of people have Oblivion and Skyrim under their belt, but has anyone played this game?
Yeah, I'm old.
Thank you, Patrick.
I remember them talking about it on Toonami when I was a kid. I have unfortunately not played it, but I do know that most people hold it in higher regard than Oblivion. And I feel like Skyrim is my entry point to the Elder Scrolls, so I don't really... and also, Morrowind sounds great, looks real old and jank. So yeah, I'll probably never go back to it. But I do like your argument for, what was it, choice...
Like, narrative opportunity costs.
Narrative opportunity costs. I think that's a very strong case to make for this game and older games in general. And I don't know why things have shifted, because, I mean, Dragon Age is in the same way, where Origins, I feel like, has like more opportunity to fuck things up and make truly horrific choices at the expense of maybe telling like an opportunity, like a better story. But that makes this, you know, it makes it a richer role-playing world. And I do like the idea of a story that allows you to basically, like you said, that it costs you something to make a choice, and the only way to change that is to start the game over. And unfortunately, I think just that's not how the industry operates anymore for games of this scale. They don't want people not seeing everything they create, or not having an opportunity to see everything they made.
What's the most memorable choice you have to make in Mass Effect 1?
Kaden!
The Vermeier sacrifice. Yeah, it's like, and it's not just who you choose, but you're losing out on the other relationship no matter what path you take.
Yeah.
For not just one game, but for all the games. Like that holds true for the whole thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can kill all your friends in Dragon Age Origins. That's pretty awesome. Almost all of them. Yeah, I do kind of miss that about like older RPG games that were way more willing to, I don't know, give you an opportunity to like tailor the story to your desires, and also just be a really evil fuck. Like I haven't had that experience in a long time with an RPG game.
Another binary option, this is like way worse. You can join the Twin Lamps, which is like the abolitionist underground railroad, like try to like free slaves and get them back to their homelands. Or you can like help the slave bounty hunters to make like a quick buck.
Jeez.
The one I always think of with that is from Knights of the Republic. This always sticks out of my mind, is that in Knights of the Little Republic on Tatooine, it's such a minor choice, but you have an option. Like, they're, I think they're called raids. It's like the giant monsters that you hunt, and you can get like a raid plate. And you specifically get one from this one beast that you bring back to Anchorhead or whatever the town is. And there's a lady there that talks about her husband who was a hunter who died, and she's trying to get off the planet. And you have the option, because you have a hunter's license, to go sell it and give her the money. But what you can do is you can go in, you can sell it, and you can go taunt in her face that you're going to keep the money and that she's fucked. She's like, jeez. So senselessly evil. And I always just like, it always just sticks in my head that is a thing you can do.
Like, sorry not to keep dragging Dragon Age into this, but like, my favorite choice in Origins is, in the one I pick every time, is to pollute the sacred ashes of Andraste, who's like the Jesus figure. And it's because you get to kill like two of your friends if they're in the party with you, which makes, especially like, I cut off Ileana's head, which makes the events of Inquisition a little hard to reconcile. But but it's such like a fuck you to the Chantry. And like, I mean, you can role play reasons for it. I always played the Dalish self, so I always, you know, I feel like I'm justified in my anger. But it's such like an evil thing. Like, you're inducted into like a dragon cult immediately afterwards. That's the kind of stuff we need in games nowadays.
Yeah, cults.
Yeah, piss in the ashes of someone's messiah. It's great fun.
I kind of have a twofold question about this, in terms of, it kind of goes back to what Katie mentioned earlier, where it's kind of a hard game to go back to, right? Like, if you look at Morrowind now, it's just doesn't look like a video game you want to play.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm curious, like, how you think that freights in its evaluation as a game, and also alongside that, like, and I wonder about this, like, as I also consider like games that I might want to represent for this, and just games in general, and how I think about them is like, how important do you think nostalgia is to your recollection of how good this game is? Do you think it like like sort of weighs heavily in how you feel about it? Like, do you think that if you played it again now, that you'd feel the same, or do you think you would enjoy it if you had never played it and you picked it up now, like that kind of stuff? Like, do you think that, like, how powerful do you think nostalgia is in your evaluation of it?
I think nostalgia certainly has some effect, and like, it does look kind of janky now, but like, the things that stick with me are like the art design and like the architecture, and like, I'm repeating myself, but like, the writing and the world building, like, I think that would still like intellectually gel with me, even if like I was older and maybe like.
You can cut this out because this is like a big spoiler, but I've always been curious, as someone who is like kind of a like an Elder Scrolls noob and has only really played Skyrim. So like, in Skyrim, everyone always talks about Morrowind and how like something bad happened there, and that's why there's Dark Elf refugees.
So,
what happens at the end of that game?
So at the end of Morrowind, you destroy the heart of Lorcan, which is like powering the Tribunal Temple and their god powers. And Vivek is like, I can still use like what's the meagerness that's left of my power to still like keep the Ministry of Truth like floating above the city. But something happens in the Fourth Age where Vivek like disappears from material reality. And all the inertia that's been building up in that meteor for centuries, it just goes whoop, right into the city. It like deletes half of Morrowind. Like, millions of people die. Like,
oh my god,
that's the tragedy.
That's actually pretty awesome. Man.
Any other Morrowind questions?
What do you think about the expansions?
My main problem with it, other than the fact that you need to use about a dozen mods just to play the game nowadays, is the difficulty with playing it if you aren't familiar with D&D and general role-playing, pen and paper role-playing games.
Go one at a time. So I would cop to the D&D thing. I really prefer the combat in Morrowind. I really like the dice rolls. I think it makes like getting, like, whether you're missing or hitting or getting a crit, it like makes it feel more meaningful than just like auto hitting everything in like Oblivion or Skyrim. So, I mean, I don't know. I really like the expansions. I think they're very flavorful and rich. Even if they're kind of short and to the point.
Don't you think it's problematic that that you can end up being attacked right away?
Oh, that, like, yeah. It's also kind of, if I recall, Patrick, like, if you kill those Dark Brotherhood assassins, like, their armor is so good, it kind of, like, breaks the beginning of the game a little bit.
That's exactly what I mean. And you get, like, lightning swords and whatever. So you get, like, you get special effects that really makes everything very easy for a long while. And that's actually my main problem with the game is the expansions for how it sort of ruins the balance of the game. Hot take, I guess. I'm looking forward to whenever they do Skywind.
Mm-hmm. Well, stuff like that's been going on for like a decade, it seems. I check in once a year, maybe. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for sharing all of that about Morrowind. It honestly very, very, very compelling case. I love non-traditional fantasy settings. And it sounds like a very, very cool one, especially that story you told about your own experience with religion and how that relates to the floating meteor in the sky. That's pretty cool. All right. Cool. Patrick, you are up next for us.
Okay. Well, let's try doing something slightly different. I'll start by asking you to visualize yourself in a dark forest, lying down. Suddenly, you gain the ability to move your body. You get up. No one's there. And, well, what to do? You don't know anything. You don't know who you are, what you're supposed to do. So you just walk. You start walking. There's some things you need to climb. You climb it up. You climb up on top of it. You find a boat. Sail on that. All the while, you meet no one. There's nothing. It's just forest with black and white. And then suddenly, you see up ahead legs, long, spindly spider legs, moving slightly. And you go up, looking towards it, and what is that? Is that a spider? Is it a friendly spider? No, it's definitely not a friendly spider. And you're dead. And you and the game that we're talking about right now is Limbo. Limbo is a short game, like 5-8 hours, where it's a side-scrolling 2D side-scrolling horror puzzler, where everything is out to kill you. It's made in a film noir atmosphere that is so, it pulls you in so tightly that you, every single time you die, and you die, or at least on your first playthrough, you'll die so many times. And most of those times are, like, it could be unfair. It could be just gruesome, like decapitations, impalement on spider legs and stuff like that. But you start figuring out the systems and you start, okay, so I can do this, I can do that. And you start building up a sort of an idea of what you're supposed to do and stuff. But then the game changes again and new puzzles come up and new ways to interact with the puzzles. I played personally with my friend when we moved to Copenhagen like 10 years ago. I played this game And we was when I was very young, I used to play a lot of games co-op, or where someone sat at a seat next to him, and then if someone died or something happened, you just the other person just took over. And hadn't done that very much at that time lately. But that game, it sort of spoke to me. I tried like 5 minutes, and then I called my friend in, and he was like, he sat down and we played the demo, because there was a demo out first. And the whole spiders scene and some things that happened afterwards, that was all included in the game, and it was so intense and actually very creepy that we were just entranced. We played it all that night, and we were just, yeah, we were enraptured. It's inside Limbo is made by the same developers as that's also made Inside, and while Inside is a more polished game, for me personally, Limbo is much more. It is one of the few, very few, video games that creep me out while playing it, and that's something. I love that. I love actually being able to. I don't get creeped out by movies or anything like that, but video games, whenever they do what they do correctly, you can really get enraptured in it. So this is why Limbo is my choice. Story wise, there isn't really a story. There's a loop, so to say. And I won't go further into that. It's sort of confusing. Although the name itself maybe alludes to what that is. A limbo being you being trapped in the edge of hell. But there is like a line they had to put on just to sell it. Because you can, you know, sell a game without any description of what the game is. So it says, uncertain of his sister's fate, a boy enters limbo. And it's just, you get to interpret the story as you want, as you like. I really like it. I like dark things. I like creepy things. I like being creepy and dark. That's so Limbo is perfect for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. That was great. Yeah, this is a great game. I am a fan of the games this guy makes. He's from Denmark, right? The guy who makes these.
The company. Yes. Everything awesome is from Denmark. You know.
Yes. I'm curious. I guess, like, does that affect your relationship to the game at all? The fact that it's from Denmark.
I didn't know when I played.
You didn't know when you played. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Any takes on Limbo?
Yeah, I mean, Inside, I like Inside better. But like you said, it's a more polished game. But I also really love Limbo, and I think the minimalism is its biggest strength. And I think, like Inside, there is something compelling about the level of violence directed at children in both the games. It's nauseating, but it's also compelling and powerful, and it kind of makes you feel, it really emphasizes your character as like a helpless agent in a dangerous and dark world where you don't really understand like the forces that are like the spiders and stuff. There's no malice involved. It's just like the world is scary and dangerous, and you are small and helpless. And like the ambiguity of the ending is, I think, pretty powerful as well. Yeah, I loved this game when it first came out, and I loved Inside even more. It's definitely like one of my favorite indie games that has come out in the last, well, I guess it's like, Jesus, when did it come out, like 2012, 2011?
Man, we're old. 2010.
Oh my god. Yeah,
so I guess, like, so yeah, I do agree that what Katie said, that I think the simplicity of the game is its strength. It's kind of interesting to compare it to what we just talked about, like Morrowind, where it's sort of like Morrowind is sort of on the other end of the spectrum in terms of like how dense it is with lore and detail. Like you can just drown yourself in story if you want to, whereas this, you're really kind of like bereft of a lot of information. You're just kind of trying to pick up what you can from the visual cues and what you see. And you know, I think a lot of the fun in that for me is like kind of getting to speculate on like what things mean. Like, what does the girl in the story mean to you, the protagonist? Like, what is their relationship and how can you suss that out based on the very limited interactions you have and like just what you're trying to do in the game? But do you think like it's too vague? Like, do you think that there should be more direction to it, or do you think that it's good that it's very ambiguous about like what all this means and what it is?
I think it's so, this is art. This game is art, and as many other art pieces that you get to, you know, experience in museums and stuff like that, I think it's supposed to make you come with your own experiences, your own subjective ideas, and insert them into the story to get yours, to make your own story. I think for me, I like Morrowind. You brought it up. I like Morrowind, but my main problem is that I get FOMO. I get fear of missing out, and I want to complete a game, and it takes very long to complete a game. While this game is short and you know you've done everything, you can go after a perfect run. That's definitely a thing you can try. But if you played it once, you don't necessarily have to play it again, and you've experienced something. You've gone away with your own experience, your own way of analyzing why the kids are attacking you, or what these different areas mean when you look at the whole, you know, otherworldly idea of him going into a limbo. I think it's just, on the whole, it's much more approachable, and even then, it's more thought-provoking for me than Morrowind was necessarily.
Yeah, well said. I especially like that point you made about how you kind of take your own experiences into the game. I think that, and how that kind of shapes your experience. I think that's definitely a good point. I think it's interesting. I think I actually remember like when this game came out, it was kind of one of the games that kind of spawned the like debate on like how you quantify a game's value. And this became like a thing of like, a game's value is literally just like how many hours that it gives you. Like you assign like a dollar value to a game, and like however many hours like that justifies its worth to you. So like, I'm like curious how you'd respond to that. Like that question of like, if a game does not give you good value for your time, does that matter? And if that matters, and also like, if a game that just kind of is meant to just like make you think or just give you thoughts, but isn't necessarily fun, is it still a good game? Like how do you respond to those kind of like critiques of a game like this, where it's just like, it's obviously a very simple game, and there's definitely a value to its simplicity, but like if all it is like you just like walk to the right and try to live, like is it, how good of a game is it?
Are you saying that it's not fun?
Well, how would you respond to that question?
I would say
the game is like if someone said something like, if a game is like bereft, and to be clear, personally, I do think it's fun, but if a game is like bereft of features that a traditional game might have, like it's just very limited in what you can actually do with it, like do you think that diminishes it in any way?
Well, I definitely don't agree that it's not fun, because it engages the storytelling part of my brain, and that's how I enjoy what I enjoy by games, the story, so to say. Even though that it doesn't do much itself, there are set pieces, there are characters there that engage you, but yeah, I think I said that before. But I think to the other point, I think you have to go more in the line of quality versus quantity. That's always an idea that you can, if you can make a seriously long game with all the quests engaging and whatever you need to do and a clear goal, incentive, whatever you want to call it, and that's great. But I would dare to say that most games, even most good games, have content that is less great. And even this game has like a sort of a slump in the later third of the game, but it's still so contained with itself that you don't feel, you know, I didn't feel at all, you know, cheated. I think when a game also keeps on playing after you stopped, after you put down the controller, if you keep on playing in your head, playing with your mind, with your ideas, you keep thinking about it, like KD and Dragon Age, that's also like hours of value, game value.
Well, I do have to ask the next question then, is that if this game had a retail price of like $60 or $70, like some games are now, do you still feel the same way? Like it still has enough quality that it's worth that price?
For two reasons, or for one reason, no. Mainly just because it is sort of, it's just a step away from being like the most perfect little contained game that you can play, or even that you can add some sort of, you know, replay value like you do in Returnal or stuff like that. You can add small bits that could make it, you know, $60 worth, but there isn't, and it's because it was new, it was different, it was a way of thinking games, thinking outside the box with games. But that said, if I'd played the demo, I would have been hooked, and I would probably have bought it, even though it cost $60.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of an unfair question. I just think it's an interesting discussion of its own, because like a lot of us, including me, like I like to talk a big game about how like indie games are amazing and how they have like a particular quality that AAA games lack. But if I was faced with buying like a 5-hour game for that price, I'd be like, fuck no. So it's interesting, like how that argument that what feels like a pretty like sort of like prosaic argument about how like a game that can just like, in like, I don't know, inundate you with as many hours of content, even if it's the most like facile, boring content, still manages to like, we still are say like, okay, yeah, I'll pay $60 for that, but we won't say the same for a short game. I just think that's an interesting thing, but yeah, I don't think you have to that says anything about Limbo or anything else.
No, I just wanted to say that for me, I've personally gone off a lot of the big sandbox games recently. I mean, I don't play Assassin's Creed. I played Assassin's Creed a lot over the first, second, and third one. I 100% did them, because that's another thing I have. I have a compulsive completionist impulse. But nowadays it's just meaningless. Yes, it's $60 worth because a lot of people worked on it, and with the marketing and everything, it costs $60 to make. That's fair. But if you just get the same gameplay loop for 20, 30, 100 hours, well, I'd like to try other games then, because most of the games that we mentioned here, like 70% of them who start the game don't finish the games. I'd rather have one I finish. Like,
yeah, it's a fair point. I think my personal alignment is much the same about how I feel about games right now. So cool. Any other thoughts, questions on Limbo before we move on?
I've played Inside, but I've never touched this game, although I know the reputation it has. So I just can't really talk the talk, unfortunately. What's the price on Steam? I'm curious.
It's like $10 or something.
Okay.
10 or 12.
Yeah, and I think it was something more before, but obviously prices for some games go down over time. But
it's right now for $2.
$2. If you would like to experience Limbo, I will tell you it is worth $2. That's for damn sure.
Definitely worth $2. Maybe even $4.
Yes. Cool. Excellent. Thank you, Patrick. All right. My turn is decided by the random order. So this is a game that I have only briefly talked about before in VOK things. It was in our 2017 video game roundtable. And the reason I only briefly talked about it there is because at the time it was only the number two game for me in what I will maintain was one of the greatest years in video game history, which is 2017. And that's, to me, like an interesting discussion of its own, like how significant that year was for gaming. And for me personally, just as a fan, like, honestly, like at least five games from that year are like comfortably in my all-time favorite list, including this one. So, and it's a game that even since then, since I played it originally in that year when it came out, it's only risen in my esteem. And it's one that I now securely consider a personal all-time favorite and certainly an all-time great. So the game is Hollow Knight. So this game was developed by Team Cherry.
Let's go.
Yes. Team Cherry, it's a small team from Australia. They originally started the game for a game jam event, and they called it a Hungry Night at the time. And the goal of the game, Hungry Night, was to eat bugs to prevent starvation, sort of a survival game experience. But people absolutely hated that. But let's say that it has developed further from that original concept since then. And it is now, you know, speaking about price and value and all that stuff, I would call this game one of the greatest value games of all time. I believe its original retail price, I believe, was something like $15, something like that. And it's worth it. I would argue that Hollow Knight has completely reset the Metroidvania genre. This is a genre that obviously began with games like Metroid and Castlevania. It's the just to describe it briefly, the idea of that kind of game is that you explore kind of a 2D map, and the goal of the game is to kind of unlock new abilities that increase your ability to traverse that map, to unlock new areas and things of that nature. And I think Hollow Knight, you know, obviously took from that mold, but it was such an important game, such a well-received game that you can look at any Metroidvania that's come out since and you can see its influence on those games. So in terms of games that kind of like define a genre or redefine a genre, Hollow Knight is certainly one of them. It has even as of this moment started to spawn like very clear like imitators that are even like aping the art style of the game that they're just trying to clearly like be like, we are Hollow Knight also, you should play this. That's definitely a thing, and you can definitely tell when a game has a significant significance in the industry when that starts to happen. Yeah, I actually would argue I don't think that there is any indie video game, and I'd be curious to see how you guys would respond to this particular claim, but I don't think there's any indie video game other than Minecraft, which has been more significant in shaping the direction of the industry at large. So to describe the game, you are the knight. You are a cute but incredibly lethal bug. You are a stranger in a strange land. You are wandering your lonely way through a very mysterious place. The first thing you find as you start the game is a home. You enter the little town of Dirtmouth, and even though it is a cold and quiet place at the start of the game, one of the joys of the experience is to fill it with more friendly bugs who will share with you all of their tragic stories. And you will always know as you delve deeper below the earth and you try to find more friends, find more things that will progress you along the way, that you have this home to return to. So, of course, like for me, a lot of what I enjoy about games are the aesthetic qualities of it. And aesthetically speaking, you know, in terms of art style, in terms of visual experience, this is both gorgeous and unique. The character art manages for me to be both charming and horrifying in turns, depending on if you're, you know, experiencing something that's more friendly to you, or you're experiencing some dark monstrous creation in some corner of the map that you've found. All of the art I understand to be hand sketched, which definitely gives it a look and style like nothing I've personally seen before. The music is composed by a man named Christopher Larkin, which is also to me absolutely gorgeous and succeeds perfectly in getting you in the mood of each place that you travel to on the map, no matter where you go. You know, whether it be the somber keys of that you hear as you enter a forgotten city filled with endless rain, or the unsettling twangs as you delve deep into tunnels full of darkness and monstrous creatures. They perfectly set the mood for each place that you're going to, as I said. So also, I would say, like, the boss themes that you experience as you find boss fights in the game are incredibly exciting, and they definitely capture the spirit of each encounter that you'll find. I think one of the reasons why I enjoy this most, and I beat this drum a lot on a lot of VOK things and a lot of, like, stories and different pieces of media I talk about, is that it's the kind of setting that I personally love, which is essentially like a world that used to be great and prosperous, that used to have this history and this majesty to it, but since then it has fallen in absolute ruin and decay. And it kind of captures for me what Alex was talking about before, that kind of idea of being like an anthropologist or an archaeologist, like going through this setting and just finding out, like, what happened? Like, how did it get so bad? Like, how did we end up in a place where, in this case, we're wandering this underground kingdom that is full of creatures that have been driven mad by some kind of disease, and they're just attacking you on sight, and you are just wandering through hollowed out cities that once you guess were prosperous and full of life. So you're wondering what happened, how did it go so wrong? And it's so fun to try to figure out how those pieces fit together, figure out how things used to be and how they got to be how they are now. And it creates this such a potent atmosphere for me. And again, like, it's all reinforced by the art, by the music, by all that kind of stuff to give you that feeling. And I think it's kind of interesting, like, for a game like this, where quite different from a game like Morrowind, there are not lore books to read. There's not exposition for you to find. There's not, like, a ton of information to be found. There's little hints you can get. But a lot of the information that you come to know about the game is just kind of experienced. It's not read. You just kind of get a feel for how things used to be just based on how you explore the world. You don't read about it. So I think that there's something special about that to me. And I think it also makes it more approachable in a way, the fact that you don't have to kind of, like, read paragraphs upon paragraphs to get a sense of what this place is like. And while that may in some ways, like, limit the denseness of the world building, I don't think it makes it any less strong. And along that same line, the characters for me are memorable, and a lot of what you feel about them is just based on their art design, based on the little weird noises they make as you talk to them. They all have, like, a very iconic sound they make whenever you go to meet them, whether you're, like, talking to the guy who sells maps or the character that sells you charms, which you give you various upgrades that are very, very cool. Yeah, you don't need, like, long... You don't need to exhaust. And again, like, I love games where you get to exhaust dialogue options and learn about characters, but you don't need that to get a feel for these characters, whether they're just, like, really funny or just comforting and friendly, intriguing, like, they're mysterious, or simply just cool. Like, every time you meet someone in the underworld of Hollow Nest, you're left with some kind of impression. And a lot like the last game I talked about, Outer Wilds, it's just sort of enormously relieving to meet someone when you're traveling around this, like, empty world, because you find someone else that's still sane in this, like, really messed up reality that you find yourself in, at least still sane right now. So exploration, again, like, as I talked about in that last game, is something that is a really core tenet of what makes Hollow Knight special. It gives you this genuine sense of diving deep below the earth to follow, to fall below, to find secret places. This experience of uncovering things, perhaps better left alone. You will definitely be confronted with some very disturbing things as you go deeper and deeper. And it doesn't signpost you. Often, if you're looking for a signpost, you'll find that it's been knocked down by someone else. So you'll definitely have a time, like, trying to figure out how things fit together in this map. It's definitely going to be a journey to piece it all together and to find the more secret things. And to me, that's very rewarding. It never feels like it's unfair. It never feels like it's trying to take advantage of you in any way, but at the same time, it challenges you. It challenges you to find the secret things. And what's cool is that, like, if you just want to experience the base story of the game, you can do that pretty quickly. You know pretty clearly what you have to do. But if you want to find those secrets, not only will it just be rewarding for its own right, but it will change your ending. It will mean something more for the game, that process of getting to know really what's going on here, to dive again deeper and deeper. But of course, that's not all Hollow Knight is. It's not all lore and story and characters. It is very much just a really, really fun platformer. It's some of the most visceral and satisfying 2D combat and traversal that I've experienced. The fighting is simplistic, but most importantly, it's really responsive and tight. It's always really clear what every button press will do. And like any good Metroidvania, it brilliantly paces the movement options you unlock to simultaneously make the combat and the exploration of the map more dynamic and exciting. You know, when you first start out, you're pretty much just a guy who walks around and swings a stick. But by the time you finish the game, you're leaping about, you're using a huge array of movement abilities, you're vaulting off people. And there are some encounters that just perfectly capture how much you've grown and how much more potential you have. And it's very seamless, like how you get from point A to point B with that, where you won't even realize how much you've grown before you're at reached that point. So it's very cool for that. So like I was saying before, the main vector for upgrades and customization is by way of the use of these things called charms, which you will just find organically as you explore. They confer all these various different gameplay benefits, whether it be more health, more damage, and you know, there's some that have kind of a double-edged sword quality to them, where you will get more of this, but you will lose something else. And it is incredibly cool to me, like how there are so many combinations available to you of how you can utilize these. Because I think in a lot of RPG games or any kind of game with progression or any kind of tools to make you stronger, there tends to be like a very cookie cutter build that emerges of like, this is the one way to play the game. And that's not the case here. Like whenever I play this, I find myself switching out my charm setup pretty regularly over the course of a single playthrough and kind of tailoring my build and my approach to whatever situation I'm dealing with. And it's super quick and easy. You don't have to like spend money to respec or any of that kind of stuff. You just go into your charm menu and you decide what you want to use for the spot. So it's really cool how that works. So speaking again about bosses, this game genuinely includes many of my favorite boss fights in any game I've played, like literally any game. It's perfectly on par with like Dark Souls or any other game in terms of like moveset, difficulty, aesthetic, like all those qualities to me that make a good boss. It's right up there. There's even one DLC boss in this game that has, in my opinion, the best intro of any boss I've ever seen. It's probably honestly like the boss I've spent the most time on of any boss in any game ever. So I love that one. And speaking of DLC, again, going back to the value thing, every DLC adds something of significant value to the game, you know, in terms of elevating the gameplay experience and also giving it some new quality, new aspect to the lore. But also, it's all free. Like, it's incredible to me. Like it's every single DLC that became available for this game, you could just download from day one that it came out. So it's the most generous relationship I've ever experienced with a game developer. And there's a reason why the fan base for this game is so loyal to the creators, because they just everything they've done like is so kind to the people that play their game. And there's something special about that. And it's definitely, you know, I think, helped to make it a success. So yeah, I could go on for a lot longer. There's a lot more things I could say, but I will not. I think the last point I'll make is that there is a reason why when they finally showed more of Silksong, the sequel for this game at an E3 thing or whatever we call it now thing recently, it was the most excited I'd been for a game in quite some time. You know, I've played a lot of games. Like, not every game captures my heart the way that they did when I was a kid, but this is one that certainly does. It still has that really powerful emotional effect on me. And for that reason, I consider Hollow Knight very special, and incredibly special to me personally. So I will end with a quote from the game. No cost too great, no mind to think, no will to break, no voice to cry suffering. You are the Hollow Knight. Thank you, guys. That is my pick for today.
Well, you just sold me on it, because I've been thinking about playing this game for a long time. Cool. That was enough enthusiasm to push me over the edge, and I think it's pretty cheap on at least yeah. the PlayStation store, from what
like
I've seen.
Like I say, these dudes, they give you great value for your buck.
I want to elbow you out of the spotlight and be like, well, here's why I think it should be a Hollow Gate.
Fair enough. You can make a case if you want.
Yeah, I think you got this. It was either for my birthday or Christmas, and I played it for like an hour with the keyboard and mouse, and I'm like, these controls are awful. This game is awful. I tabled it.
I bounced off it when I first started too, but it's the thing with all games, really. Like, for me, like in any game, like I need an hour before I'm like into it, definitely.
And then 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic, I was like, maybe I should give Hollow Knight another shake. And I had the forethought to actually just rebind everything. And I sunk like 60 hours into this game in like 2 weeks.
Oh, did you actually play it with keyboard and mouse? Like, this game should be played with a controller.
No. I do things my own way.
I've offered to just send Alex a controller, but he just resolutely refuses to ever play anything with a controller that's on a PC.
You know, this game is incredible. And it's only like, I feel like it's only grown in estimation over time. As things like try to imitate it or try to like do other things, you just like kind of go back and just realize like how special it is. I mean, the only criticisms I have for it are some of the end game stuff is probably a little overly obnoxious. At least in terms of like collecting some of like the final charms, which are really expensive, and and your source of income, I feel like, is limited at that point in time, and the losing it all on death can be so punishing. Especially when you travel all the way across the map, that's probably the only kind of criticism I would give it, was there should have been a little ease in some of those like final charms and collectibles for 100%. But otherwise, like, this game is fantastic.
You just gotta invest all that money in the bank.
In the bank, yeah.
Well, no, but like it goes, like I lost, you know, I did that early on, and then like, you know, you then she runs away with it, and then you get it back, and then that's it.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, like, I mean, this is a component of games in general, where, like, I do think that if you wanted to get all that stuff, you'd have to, like, farm, you'd have to just go kill bugs for a couple hours to get everything, which, you know, yeah. It's not always fun, but those charms are very good. It's very nice to have them, so, yeah.
So I'm racking my brain, like, this game is pretty hard. And at least when I was playing, like, I was, like, locked into, like, what I thought were very optimal, like, overpowered charms. And I was, like, not customizing at all, where a lot of stuff seemed, like, superfluous, like, fluff. Like, do you really think it's as robust that you can, like, swap out as much as you say?
I do, and I think, like, for me, like, different encounters do demand different things that are uniquely valuable there. I a question I would ask you with that is, like, did you use like a lot of magic when you played, or mostly just stuck with your nail as your main like weapon?
I just stuck with the nail.
So actually, if you want to be optimal, the magic is way stronger. So I think, yeah, that kind of makes the point for me. Like for you, you had a build that really worked for you with the nail, but if like you were actually trying to be like the most damage possible, there's a whole other way you could play the game that you didn't. So
yeah, that's actually probably, that was one of my downfalls, where, because yeah, I never did like 100, you know, 10% this game, and yeah, and I think it's because like my gameplay style, it was the same in Sekiro too, tends to be just bare bones, like just straight sword combat. And there was some stuff at the end that I was like really struggling with and never like pushed through and really like got a hold of the magic, which I know is just real strong in certain scenarios.
All right. Any other opinions, thoughts on all of it?
It would be, it's kind of difficult for me to articulate, but usually when people use atmospheric as a buzzword, I kind of roll my eyes.
Like, yep.
It's usually just like, we're aping this kind of Souls-like dark fantasy mood, but like this game is atmospheric.
Like, yeah.
Wandering like the City of Tears with like that melancholic music. Like there's really no feeling that comes close.
And they even do little things that reinforce it. Like even just the idea of like sitting on the bench. I don't know. It completely reinforces that experience. And like, it is a good point. Like a lot of games, especially like, and you can feel that, of course, the Dark Souls influence on this. Like Dark Souls definitely is, you could say, a progenitor of what a lot of this game is trying to do. But this game just, it stands on its own. Like it does not like rest on any of that. It completely, like in ways, it's even better than things that game does. So there are a lot of 2D Dark Souls games, and a lot of them are pretty basic and not that interesting in what they do. Hollow Knight is not one of those. That's what I would say. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, let's keep it moving here because we are running pretty long, but it's been a fantastic discussion, so that's okay. But you're up next, Matt. It is your turn.
Oh, thought I was going to go clean up. All right, so I'm sticking with kind of a similar thing I did the last time with, you know, picking a focus on a particular sub-genre. And this time we're doing turn-based tactical RPGs. And so in kind of the early 2000s, these types of games started to make their way over to America. As it been often a Japanese-centric, I feel, subgenre. And they were mostly released on the handheld stuff with, like, Game Boy Advance and stuff like that. And so kind of the first ones got over here, and it was, like, Final Fantasy Tactics series, the, like, Armor Wars series, which, you know, I kind of, like, heard of a little bit. I don't think I played them before I played this. I think this series is kind of the first of the series that I've played. Maybe I played one of the Armor Wars games, or Advance Wars. But I played this series, and it pretty much just ruined the rest of the genre for me. because I liked it so much, and I would go in and try to find other games that could, like, even come close, and nothing ever did in terms of their style, with eventually the exception of XCOM. But XCOM still, there's still some things about XCOM that are not like this. And so this series is Fire Emblem. And the first two kind of that released in America is technically the seventh and eighth games of this series. So, you know, in here it was just Fire Emblem and then Fire Emblem the Sacred Stones. Officially, it's, you know, Fire Emblem 7, the Blazing Blade, and Fire Emblem 8, Sacred Stones. And these games are, to me, are incredible. And so, like, unique in kind of their own field and just the whole thing all together. They've just kind of developed a really, like, strong fan base over the years, and these games are also, like, so much kind of, like, instilled in me that even the later games of the series I get angry when they shift away from these. Like, almost, like, really the only other one in the series that I thought made, like, really, like, good changes was surprisingly the GameCube one with Path of Radiance. Actually made a few changes that I thought were better. Anyway, specifically the game I'm picking is Sacred Stones, the eighth one. Just because I think it polished up a few things from 7 that it polished up a few things and kind of, you know, gave you, like, a little more freedom of choice and made it more kind of impactful how you're playing through the game. It is a little bit easier within those changes, but I overall like the customization probably a little better than I do in 7. So the main draw for these that is different from most tactics games, including XCOM, is that each individual character you have is a unique character with kind of like a set backstory and design. You could still do some customizable things, like, with them, kind of going through the story, but you're not, like, you know, building any of these characters from the ground up. Like, I mean, you know, XCOM, you can technically, like, name your characters and have some fun with it that way, with, like, role-playing stuff. But a lot of them, you know, in other games just feel like disposable throwaways where, like, characters are meant to die. And that is not the case in these games. So, yeah, I think the main appeal of these games is kind of the tactical challenge of them, with the combination of trying to keep everyone alive, as well as kind of, like, build your story throughout. And that, and just, like, that feel of, like, losing a character is really not matched in any other game. And when that happens, you typically, like, unless you're, you know, doing certain runs, like, you that's where you have to stop and quit and replay the entire chapter from the ground up. And so one of those, like, that challenge is a lot of fun to me. And, you know, I know with kind of the more recent iterations of these games, they added in the casual mode, where you get your characters back if they die during a, you know, at the end of the chapter. Which I'm certainly not here to argue against accessibility in video games, but it does feel like not, you know, playing it not on kind of the classic mode just kind of takes away like a core aspect that I think draws me to this type of game. So that's something I always appreciate about it. And so the stories tend to be the same, you know, throughout them all. You know, you have one to two to three different lord characters. They're usually, you know, upcoming heir, prince, princess, whatever. Some, you know, they're part of one kingdom within a set of kingdoms. One of those kingdoms is usually, you know, authoritarian and tries to start a war, and you get ousted and basically have to lead a rebellion. And then there's usually a dark magic force that, like, someone's a dragon or a demon at the end of the game that you have to kill. Like, you know, that's kind of the generic, like, storyline you go through. That's not really the core of what I'm going through these games for. The core is the actual gameplay and strategy of it all itself. I will say that Sacred Stones has a particular good storyline between kind of your two prince characters that you control, Erica and Ephraim, and their relationship and childhood friend, Leon, who kind of becomes an antagonist over the course of the game. And you kind of see, you know, you see them interacting throughout the course of the game, and you get kind of several flashbacks, you know, as you go through it, of them, of their previous kind of like meeting and friendship and growing up together, kind of like wards or whatever, like it would be with Robert and Stannis, or Robert and Ned. And the final one that it ends on is a scene that is actually always stuck with me as a particular narrative choice I really enjoyed. I won't spoil it here, but whatever, it's not a huge deal. So overall, you know, I love the challenge of it. Seven is definitely a little harder than these, than eight is, but like, it's still, you know, it's not something you're just gonna walk through, you know, even on normal difficulty. Another thing I like with eight is the more customization, where basically, you know, each character is kind of like a set class, and you go and you level up, and then you eventually get to level 20, and then you upgrade them to another class that you can then level up to level 20. If you get that far, you rarely do you have characters that max 20 throughout the entire playthrough. It's just not that long. But kind of the eight gives you a more customizable option, where each character, instead of just going to one preset upgrade path, you get two choices to choose between, so you can customize a little more. You even get kind of like three child characters, which are essentially like, you know, the pre-evolutions in Pokemon, like a Pichu or something, where they start at, like, you know, in below a class below the original classes of most characters, so you have, you know, much wider upgrade path through them, and you get, you know, some, like, I think like six different end choices instead of just two. So that's fun to be able to build it out. And then a big change that this game made is that in between the individual main story chapters, it's a story that just flows, you know, from one chapter to the next. You do get a choice in the middle of going down two separate paths that eventually reconverge, whether you choose Erica's storyline for five chapters or Ephraim's storyline for five chapters. So it splits off a little bit that way to give you some more replayability. But it's not, it's mainly like a linear story path. But kind of in between those chapters, it gives you kind of these little skirmishes that you can go through. to level up your characters some more. And the main thing this does is allow you to basically use whatever character you want. And if anyone, because you're limited to the amount of characters you can bring to each map. And so you can use these other things to kind of like level up some of the ones that you didn't use. And this is actually a problem that a lot of the Fire Emblem games have, where some characters just suck and are really like useless, or they come in too late and it just requires like too much effort to really get them into your main party. But this game, with the adding this on here, really gives you the option of using whoever you want. Any character is viable, which is a pretty unique thing, and even within the Fire Emblem series itself. So I really enjoy that aspect of it. It does make the game a little easier, obviously, getting that extra experience, but I think it's worth it, and just giving you the true option of using, you know, really playing this game however you want, and using whatever team you want, however creative or challenging you want to make with it. The other big one is the final thing is kind of the support system. And this is really kind of your more story choice elements, where each character, you know, gets a choice between 5 support conversations. And basically what that means is that you can create an A support with someone, which requires 3 conversations, and a B support someone with another character, which requires 2. And so this is kind of like where you make your pairing story options and like what characters you want to like link together in terms of, you know, kind of epilogue stuff you get. And they also obviously then help each other in battle, depending, you know, they have like affinities. You get different stat bonuses by pairing different characters together. And so you're kind of like matching, you know, what, you know, the story elements you want to put together, as well as like what's most efficient and effective on the battlefield. And that's one of my favorite things to do, is kind of go through the list, and I literally map it out of each character, what 2 pairs they'll get, to try like maximize on it. That's a really fun min-max thing you can do. And this is one of the last games in the series that did this, that had this kind of like strict support system. The other ones kind of did away with it and kind of like widened the scope of it to be able to kind of like support, you know, whoever you want. But like the bonuses weren't as impactful and the story elements weren't as impactful. And so that really annoyed me. I really liked the focus of being able to kind of customize and build out your RPG elements like how you want to. It does have an annoying aspect. In order to build these support characters, you have to just stand them next to each other, which takes a long time, but that's kind of what the side skirmishes are for, to just kind of level that up over the course, you know, as you need to. So yeah, that is kind of about it with all these elements. This is a particular subgenre that I've always liked. I've always been a strategy, RPG focused kind of player when it comes to video games, and this is by far the best series I've ever played, and it's, you know, it's stuck with me throughout a good portion of my life. You know, I even just bought the new Fire Emblem Dynasty Warriors game, kind of this spin-off from the recent Switch release, which was, you know, certainly fun and popular amongst a lot of people, although it's a little different in gameplay style than what I've liked from these original ones that I played when I was younger. And so yeah, that's it.
Cool. Thank you very much, Matt. Yeah, I think the main line that I'm curious to kind of explore a little further is, so I like this series a lot, and I like a lot of the games this company has made. But so I've only played the last 3 Fire Emblem games, starting with Awakening in 2013. So I'm curious to me, like, if you could like speak to a little further, like, what about the older games to you is not quite there for these, the ones that are more recent?
It's like Awakening, and then what is it? There's the one that has like the 3 of them built into each other. Yeah, this is gonna be hard, because I tried to play, you know, both of those, and then like stopped after a few chapters. Like, fuck this. The Yeah, that weird 3-in-1 game is honestly just too complicated to get all set up.
this is a valid complaint, and it's also very hard to even play it anymore because it's not accessible to buy.
Yeah. You know, I think I have it like officially, like, you know, I bought the one and downloaded the others. I think I got it, but I don't know. I never could get into it. I think it's one of those ones. I mean, I think it's similar to the Three Houses thing where, you know, there's like three individual like storylines that are completely separate from each other. And I think that limits the characters you can recruit in like each one. So, yeah, I mean, like, that's a real thing that I've now, even in Three Houses, I'm a little like, it's kind of annoying where, you know, you have four different story paths in Three Houses, and so you have to play the game four different times to get through all of them, and you can't use every character in each, you can only use, you know, certain characters and certain playthroughs, and because there's four different ones, then like the overall chapter count is only like, you know, 19 to 22 chapters, which is relatively like short. I much prefer like just a straightforward 30 chapter Fire Emblem experience. That's stuff I have not liked. It was either like Awakening or Fates that introduced the pair up system. I cannot fucking stand that. It completely destroys the balance of the game in both good and bad scenarios. And it was hard for me to like even figure out how it worked. And so just like, and so I kind of, you know, metaphorically just threw the game against the wall. Like, enough of this. No, I want like a straight, just individual characters, you know, a team of 12 to 15 guys, you know, we got this squad of enemies to beat, we're going against them, with just our individual selves and our strengths and weaknesses and our team, you know, our support bonuses, and that's how we're doing this, you know, bare bones, straight up style. That's really what drew me in any time of these like weird complications on top of it, and I don't like it as much, and it tends to break the game. You know, Three Houses have a thing where you can literally make any character into any class, and and they're easily, you know, namely the Wyvern Rider in Three Houses is the most overpowered class in the entire game, and you can make a team of just like eight of those guys to the point that you can get to the final chapter of a game and complete it in one turn by just like boss rushing, you know, the final thing with, you know, however many Wyvern Riders it takes, plus a dancer and all this other stuff. Like, it, you know, the more they add to it, the more it tends to be impossible to balance properly.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about how, like, the more flexibility the games give you in terms of, like, how you customize your characters, or even, like, how you, like you were talking about before, with how you like pair them up, or you like what path you choose for support conversations and who ends up linking together, it can kind of actually dilute everything if you have a lot of like too much freedom there, because it just ends up making everything feel less, because they have to like do so much more work to like give you those options. So it kind of speaks in favor of just having a tighter, more focused experience, and just having a more clear sense of like who the characters are going to be and what their relationships are going to pan out as, because then you just don't have to write as much permutations. So it's interesting, like how just have just like overwhelming you with options isn't always the way to go. Like, sometimes you just want a simple, straightforward approach to things.
Yeah, that's always been my preference in RPGs, is like you should definitely have a choice between a few things, and that's a big reason why I picked 7 over 8, because it gives you slightly more choice in your customization, but it's still within like a set structure. And you know, I mainly like it just because I like to have a starting point direction, so I kind of have a sense of where I want to go with this, and then, you know, it's just kind of a few big choices here and there to kind of like steer it in the direction I want. But I prefer to have a more structured approach to at least start out with, and when it comes to RPGs.
I do concur with you that classic is the way to play, because like there's something about just the pressure of losing a character that just adds so much to the game. I will say though, I am definitely a save scummer, so I'm lying to myself as I say that.
Yeah, like especially because like the best way to play it nowadays is, you know, with some of these old ones is through emulators, and yeah, you can really I will definitely use it then just to save time. I mainly use it to stop myself from getting level ups with zero stats, like basically like yeah, like just stat level. Yeah. Minimum three is usually my thing. Like minimum three stat upgrades per level up, because that does get annoying. They should have set that to like, you know, that no matter what happens, you should have a minimum of two stats like per upgrade. So it doesn't feel worthless after you've pumped 100 XP into a character.
Too much painful RNG.
That's actually my main problem with this game is the whole RNG level up system. And that there's systems or way like guides how to you burn or random numbers. it sort of defeats the purpose. Also saves coming in. It means like you have to break the game to make it better. That's sort of weird for me.
Fair point.
Yeah, it's in the end, it's really not necessary. Like, obviously, yeah. I played all these, you know, growing up before any of that, and yeah, I never bothered to learn how to do that weird stuff where you just move the cursor around a bunch to like get the level up that you want. Yeah, I never bothered learning how to do that. That's silly.
Something about that though is like, I don't know, it adds something to me. The fact that people came up with weird voodoo to do that stuff, because it reminds me of like when I was a kid, like learning how to like duplicate Pokemon and rare candies and like all this stuff. It's just like, I don't know, it adds something to the like that real world lore of games that people came up with this nonsense.
At most, you basically like if you get someone like a character with really bad level ups, you just kind of stop using them and implement someone else. Like you usually have plenty of other options to replace them if that's, you know, really an issue. You know, with 8, you can just keep leveling the characters up, so that even if you get some bad rolls, like by the end of it, they usually are perfectly fine and perfectly powerful in terms of being able to complete the game.
Definitely some confirmation bias where you're like, I only get bad level ups, but you probably only got like 2. It's just the ones you remember, you know?
Yeah. But yeah. Especially in 8, like the growth rates for the two lords are so absurd that they max out almost every stat.
There you go. Yeah, I would say just the last point I would make is that for me, I think in terms of tactics games, like I do love XCOM and stuff like that, and it's fun to like have the custom characters, but there's something special about having like established characters with identities and seeing how those identities intertwine. Like that's something about Fire Emblem I really love. So I think it makes it stand out compared to some other games like that.
Yeah. I mean, the support conversations from those early games just aren't matched at all in the most recent iterations. And it really bugs me.
All right. Thank you, Matt, very much for that. So you've been waiting patiently this whole time, Bing. It's your time. It's your time to bring the house down. Bring us home.
Yeah, so I'll try to make this just shorter since it's been a long time now. So my choice is Undertale, I don't know how many. And so this is probably one of the most, I would argue, one of the most influential games to have come out in the past decade. In that, think about how many games after Undertale do you see, and in that were sort of these one person or few people creations, indie games that sort of tries to manipulate not just the gameplay but you know, things like menus, codes, texts, things like that to create a whole story. So Undertale was created by this guy, Toby Fox, and almost everything was created by him except for the art, which was mostly drew by his partner, Temi Chang. And so the thing about Undertale is it's supposedly like a very old-fashioned 2D RPG in the style of games like Earthbound and so on, but it adds you an extra sort of option during encounters with monsters and so on, in which you get a choice of not just to battle or to run away or use items or whatever, but you also get to choose to act. You get to interact with the enemy in a way that doesn't involve them having to fight them. You get to engage in dialogue with them, and eventually, if you act in certain ways, the enemies will just leave, or you'll even make friends with them. And from this basis, the game then weaves together a story in which it manages to use the whole every aspect of the game to tell its story, and that does not include all the text and the dialogue, but also includes menu options. It includes the very foundational codes of the games themselves to tell a whole story of a story in which a young kid falls down a mountain, encounters a world of monsters, and trying to understand, well, what, not just, okay, how do I get out, but, well, why are the monsters there? What do they want? What are their purposes? And when we talked a lot about choice and the nature of choice in video games in several of our previous discussions of other games, well, in Undertale, when you make your choices, and by the, some of those choices will have very significant, well, essentially it will change the very nature of the game itself. I think infamously, there's the choice of, if you just continue to kill monsters, and you eventually it will railroad your path down one specific route, in which you basically, the character that you play, or maybe even you yourself, feel killing monsters is fun. I like killing monsters. Let's kill all of them. And then the game will actually, then the story will then railroad you down a path in which you can't stop killing monsters. You have to keep the game keep pushing you to kill more and more monsters until you kill every single monster in this game, and that has its own specific consequences. Or the other direction, I don't want to kill every monster. I don't want to kill any monster. I will try to make friends with all of them. That will then send you on another path into a different ending. And these two stories, there's a quote-unquote genocide path and a quote-unquote pacifist path, they're all one part of a larger integrated story. I think the problem with, I think the perception of Undertale is that the fandom that has sort of emerged around it has sort of become rather toxic in many different ways. And one way is that there just seems to be a very bizarre idea that there's the right way to play this game, there's the wrong way to play this game. And if you play the pacifist route, it shows you're a good person. If you play genocide route, then it shows you're a bad person, or so on. Or that you must play this game in this order. I don't think that was the intention of Toby Fox, I think, at all. And in fact, this sort of mentality detracts from the actual game itself, in which experiencing suddenly how different options take you to different places is in itself one of the greatest aspect of this game. So, and again, if we're going to talk about how the influence of this game going forward, you think about games like Doki Doki Literature Club and games like, or other games like IB and so on, that these sort of games that sort of all become played to death by your favorite YouTuber, which serves as React content for them, that they all sort of, you can all trace their routes directly back to Undertale. And you can say that's a good thing, that's a bad thing, but ultimately I think what Undertale does, or the greatest influence of the Undertale, is that it shows you the possibility of what games could do. It expands on the possibilities of what games can do, and the storytelling possibilities of gaming. And you don't have to just be restricted to what to the boundaries that have been previously set, and that even with very, very limited means, this game was made in Game Maker Studios with 2D sprites, sometimes very crude drawings, but it has a soundtrack that is made by a single person, made by the same person, Toby Fox. Amazing soundtrack that complements the storytelling, and it shows you that even with all these with monetary restrictions, with funding restrictions, with restrictions in gameplay possibilities and so on, you can still make an amazing game. That you don't have to go down the 3D, really go down the tentpole route of having to make massive games. That you can make just as good of a game, an even better game, even with limited resources. I'll just stop here.
Sure. Thank you very much, Bing. Undertale, any immediate reactions to this one?
I've heard so much about this game. Like, I know it has such a reputation. What's the actual gameplay? Like, what do you do in this game?
It's a RPG in the sense that you encounter monsters, and then you add the battle systems. Actually, so if you played things like Toho or other bullet hell shooters, it's sort of like that, but it has a lot of creative interpretations of how to deal with that. But again, there's the extra option that you can act and interact with the monsters in other ways that doesn't involve battling them. And then you can instead decide to just befriend them instead of killing them. But then there's the whole story that's weave all around it, and in which even the battle system itself is part of the story, integrating and putting into part of the story.
So I think, obviously, so I love this game. I'm really into what it does. Like all the things you mentioned about how it kind of moves the genre forward in terms of how you can approach storytelling and how you can use the particular medium of gaming to do specific things that others can't. I always love that kind of stuff. I love how self-aware it is. I love just like how it interrogates like the way that we play games. I think that's all cool. But I think what gets lost also is just that this game has one of the most heartfelt stories like of any game I've played. Mm-hmm. And of course, like you say, the music and all things like that reinforce it. But the characters are just so lively. Like they just come to life in such a strong way. The dialogue is great. Like it's so funny. Like there's so much good humor in the game that really, really lands for me. And it also kind of intertwines with sort of these like these thematic intentions, the way that the characters like approach how they live as like monsters. Like what is it like to be a monster? That kind of stuff. Like it's really cool. Like, I do have a couple interrogations of it. One being you mentioned like how influential it is. So I was actually thinking about this independently, like before I even know this would be your game the other day. I was wondering like what is the influence of Undertale? Like what are the effects we have felt since it came out like 7 years ago? You mentioned Doki Doki. What was the other game you said?
Ib, but there's also a ton of others I can talk about as well.
Sure. Like I only know one other game that I played that is clearly doing the stuff Undertale is doing than the ones you said. I don't quite feel the influence on that level, at least like that it hasn't like penetrated my consciousness as a game player, but mm-hmm. I'm sure there are a lot of games, but it just doesn't feel like it quite had the effect that I thought it would. So like, how would you respond to that?
So again, I'm not talking about directly influencing, like doing exactly what Undertale is trying to do. We're talking about the idea of using very limited resources in order to create a much more top-down, fully integrated gameplay.
Sure.
This idea, and I'm not saying Undertale is the progenitor of doing exactly that. Undertale itself was influenced by other games that came before it. That had the try a similar approach I mentioned Earthbound earlier. But Yeah, especially during a time in which, especially when you think about it in the 2010s, in which you have all these sort of big, giant tentpole games and feel like gameplay is focused much, much more and more on how can we get the most spectacular graphics, how much more gaming can we cram into this single game, and so on. Undertale is going the directly opposite direction. It opens up an avenue in which gaming that, again, because of how successful it became, it opens up an avenue of game creation that said you don't have to do all of that to make it just make a really, really good game.
So what you're saying is that the point they're making is that a game could be ugly and still be good.
Yeah. And I don't think Undertale is like a it has its own artistic appeal, but it's pretty. Some people could say it's pretty ugly. Yeah, sure.
It's special.
It's using very, very basic assets in using Game Maker Studio. All of you guys can use Game Maker Studio and make a game that has the same look as Undertale. It's not, but that's the idea. And even the aesthetics itself, with how basic it is, itself became part of the was integrated into not only the gameplay but also integrated into the story itself. So yeah,
and there's like a sort of mimetic quality to some of the weird character designs. Like it definitely like
I would say
had some influence.
Yeah, I will point out when you mentioned like humor, that's very something that might be very, very subjective.
Sure.
Yeah, the very internet-y humor that Toby Fox likes to go down that route very often in the dialogue. That could be annoy people rather than appeal.
Sure. I will say, though, like, a lot of that maybe comes across in, like, some of the more throwaway monsters, but I think there's, like, genuinely, like, really good characterizations of some of the, the actual main characters that are, I would say most people would respond to, but who knows, of course. Like, everyone has their own taste. But yeah, your point about how, like, especially in the 2010s, it really felt like games were becoming very homogenized about, like, what they were like.
Yeah.
So definitely, in terms of just breaking very cleanly from that, I think Undertale definitely is a key part of the story of games that have gone away from that. So for sure. I guess my other thing is, like, you mentioned the toxic fandom and how, like, a lot of the issue is that the fan base wants you to play the games a certain way. I think my perception is the reason why they're like that is that to like fully experience the true full quality of the genocide ending or the pacifist ending, you actually have to do some very specific things. Like you can beat the game if you're doing the pacifist route, quote unquote, beat it, but there's actually more content you have to go do, which might not be like clear to the player. So I'm wondering, like, is the reason why the fandom wants you to see that stuff so much is because it's obviously like some of the best stuff in the game, but it's not the game isn't obvious about telling you to go get that. Do you think that there's some weakness in the game in terms of like for genocide, you have to like clean up the maps very precisely of all the monsters and all that kind of stuff?
Definitely limitations in what the game could do in terms of trying to push you in a certain direction. So I feel like at least with the pacifist ending, the game gives you enough chance to already without having to other people to tell you exactly this, you must do this, you must do that.
Fair.
And I think the genocide ending is specifically was originally intended to for certain types of players who revel in playstyle of, for example, what do you do during some certain players in Pokemon, they like to grind, right? You go back to the beginning areas and kill a bunch more monsters in order to get to a certain higher level, even perhaps even higher level than you need to in order to get to, in order to breeze through later bosses or later gyms or whatever. And I feel like the original intention was, what happens when you grind too much in the initial area? And then suddenly you notice it's that, wait a minute, this is very, very different.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The experience of grinding is sort of like part of the thematic quality of that approach, because like it's meant to make you feel bad. Like in the process of becoming all powerful, like you just start to feel kind of gross, which I think is the point it's trying to make.
Sure. Yeah, it's sure. But it's creating a story out. It's creating, weaving a story around that.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. Again, the idea that you're a bad person if you're doing that. I don't agree with that, and I don't really. And I feel like the what came after you go down that route specifically. There's only really two battles in that route that matter. But those two battles are exceptionally hard. But also, to certain people, they're probably the most rewarding and most fun battles in this entire game.
Banger music as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, like it's the genocide, like the way you're describing it, the genocide ending is not necessarily just to make you feel like a bad person, but it actually is its own experience. All right. Thank you very much, Bing, for that. And with that, we will conclude our second set of presentations for the VOK Video Game Hall of Fame. Honestly, as it was before, so much fun, guys. Really, really cool to see all the ways that people approached it. This was great again, and it further reinforces how much we should keep doing this format, because it's really cool. With that, though, the most nerve-wracking part begins, the voting. The voting will begin now. So this is a tough one. Like I have no idea what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to think about it. But so just to re-describe how this works, if you could just send me your votes for three different games that you would like to say that should be inducted, identify which you would like to give 3 points, which you would like to give 2 points, and which you'd like to give 1 point, and I will tally them up and announce the winners. So yeah, just send them to me in whatever form you deem best. I will do that. Thanks, y'all. It was very good.
Yeah, no, I've spent like the past like 5 to 10 minutes like deliberating with myself, because I had like 4 games. Hard. I had to choose which one to throw out.
I don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm thinking about it right now.
Yeah, the Edelgard Targaryen like parallels are so so fucking funny to me. And just so blatant.
Yeah, watch what you say about my waifu.
Oh no! Like that was clearly the first the first path I took, the first playthrough I made for that game, was with her. Yeah, I mean down to like the silver hair and purple eyes and everything. Like ridiculous.
Okay.
I think when they made Three Houses, they definitely watched a lot of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Do I have yours, Patrick?
No, I'm still sure. I'm very it's difficult.
I'm just making sure. I'm still thinking about it too. Yeah, I've only done Three Houses with I did the Edelgard route, but I betrayed her.
That's the last one I have to do.
It's probably the least cool one, probably.
Yeah, I would assume so. So yeah, I did.
You align yourself with the church. Who wants to do that? Who wants to align themselves with the church?
Yeah. I hope this Dynasty Warriors game is good.
Did that just come out?
Yeah. I think on Friday.
Never played one of those.
Oh, I love Dynasty Warriors.
I kind of want to do the Persona.
Persona 5 one is actually not bad.
Yeah, I might do that one.
Really? Yeah, I definitely have avoided that one.
Katie, did you see that Persona 3 is coming to current devices?
No, I didn't see that. That's ironic because I've been...
Persona 3 Portable.
Oh my god, really?
Wait, is that one? Yeah.
That's my preferred
Portable. The one with the female lead.
Oh my god. When is this
you get
happening?
To save. Was there a date?
And it said later this year, the first one.
Okay. I was just like literally like yesterday and today, I was just lamenting that like there's no like updated port for the portable version. Because that's my favorite Persona game, and that's my favorite version of it.
To clarify, Patrick, so you're saying that the thing at the top here is your most weighted one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was trying to make it more, like, by saying that, top choice, that was my top choice, and then the other ones are second and third.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know if I can go back to Persona 3, but
it's hard to go back. Like, it's especially like having yeah, Tartarus sucks. but I like that.
It's better than PCP. It's better than PCP.
Yeah, I mean, like 5 is the best Persona game in my opinion, but like 3 is my favorite story. So.
Yeah, no, actually, that's something I've probably been debating is going back to either 3 or 4 to try those.
Can someone tell me? I was thinking about something else, trying to pick something. But can someone tell me what's actually fun about Dynasty Warriors? Because I've tried one and I really didn't.
I think that's a very personal and subjective thing. I've always loved Dynasty Warriors games. I could not really tell you. Like, I don't really know how to sell it to you, but that's just something I've always loved. But like, that's another series where it's just like the first ones I played, I think, were like 4 and 5, and I just feel like all other ones aren't as good as those. I think 5 was kind of like the optimal style in terms of what they did with that.
Yeah, it was too hack and slashy for me.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's the main thing, where it's that, either you like that, I feel like either you like that element or don't, because, yeah, it's just purely just hack and slash, just, like, mow down some guys.
Yeah,
there's some fun strategy I like in it, for the ones that are good and, like, do it right.
Mm.
I picture this as the kind of game where you, like, turn a podcast on and you just murder things for an hour.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%.
Which is totally reasonable.
If you don't mind the gameplay, I think you usually get into it by playing the Dynasty Warrior games associated with franchises that you like. Because the base Dynasty Warrior games, even I like the Three Kingdoms period, and I don't like the whatever's in those games.
All right. Y'all ready? Y'all ready to hear the
Let's
go. All right. So I will start at the bottom, like Drake. the two games that had 2 votes this time, which were Limbo and Minecraft. But still, I really loved both of those presentations. Genuinely, like, they're really, really good. So appreciate those very much, you guys.
Wait, how many did those get?
2 each.
Okay.
Then we had Fire Emblem Sacred Stones with 4
votes. Not last. Let's go.
No 0 votes this time.
Well, what was it? 4 points, you said?
4 points for Fire Emblem Sacred Stones. Then we had Undertale with 5. So then we have our top 3, and we will learn which 2 will be inducted. So we had, with 6 votes, our third thing, Dragon Age 2.
Woo!
Thank you, Katie. Genuinely, I love that game, even though most people hate on it. It's still really fun.
It's an honor.
Not as much as you, but... Cool. So that means that our top 2 with 12 and 11 votes, respectively, are Morrowind, The Elder Scrolls 3 Morrowind, and Hollow Knight. So those are our 2 inductees into the VOK Video Game Hall of Fame. Thanks everyone so much for doing this. Again, it was so much fun. I really enjoy this. We should definitely do more of these. It's been great. So appreciate y'all very much for coming. And we'll wrap it there, I think. We've been going quite a while.
Yeah.
And I gotta edit this. Cool. All right, thanks everyone very much for coming. Thank for you. This. We'll see you next time.
All right.
Night, everybody. If you want to check out more VOK, you can do so at VOKpodcast.com, etc. Please join us in Discord if you want to talk video games or anything else. We'll be there for you. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Adios.